Hello, my name is Andrew Zai, and I'm the social media chairman for two conferences coming to Boston in 2019, the IEEE Symposium on Phased Array Systems and Technology and the IEEE Radar Conference. Rather than simply creating some social media pages to distribute information, I've decided to try something a little different for these conferences. As an avid consumer of audio-only content, I've decided to try my hand at a podcast. My intent is to provide interesting content in the related fields of radar systems and phased array systems to help build up some excitement for the upcoming conferences. In the podcast, I will conduct interviews with industry experts to probe their insights on these fields. If you have any comments, concerns, or recommended guests, please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn or through the contact page on my website, AndrewZai.com. My first guest is Ray O'Mara. He is a retired Air Force colonel and was an F-15 pilot for the beginning of his career. In this episode, we discuss the tactics of dogfighting, how airborne radars are actually used by the pilots, how phased arrays were a game changer for air-to-air combat, and the possibilities of future air combat. I hope you enjoy. Hello, I'm sitting here with my first guest. It's appropriate that this is my pilot episode because he's a pilot himself, a fighter pilot actually, and his name is Ray O'Mara. I'm glad that I'm on a first name basis with him because his title is somewhat confusing. He's both a retired colonel in the Air Force and also has his PhD from MIT, so he's Dr. Colonel. I'm not sure how you actually write that in his signature, but I'm sure he has that figured out. So Ray, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Thank you. I retired from the Air Force almost 2 years ago now. I spent 29 years in. I had the great privilege to be able to fly the F-15 for almost 20 years. Also had the opportunity to serve on the Air Force's air staff at the Pentagon, and also spend a long time in our professional education system down at Maxwell Air Force Base, where I was the chairman of the strategy department at the Air War College. From an education standpoint, I got my bachelor's degree from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in electrical engineering. Got a couple of master's degrees through the Air Force in strategic studies-oriented things, and then, as you mentioned, had the opportunity to go to MIT and get my PhD in technology policy and engineering systems.
So you mentioned that during your flying days, you flew the F-15. Can you talk a little bit about what the mission is of an F-15 pilot?
Sure. The model of the airplane that I flew is the single-seat version, so the F-15A and C. The trainer versions are the F-15B and D, but the airplane that I flew was specifically designed for the air superiority mission. So while early in its life, the F-15, I'll call it the F-15C, did have the ability to carry bombs, over time we took that capability off the airplane as we had to make room in the central processor for more and more advanced air-to-air capabilities. So the airplane was designed specifically for an air-to-air role for dogfighting and shooting down other aircraft rather than the F-15E, which is an evolution of the F-15 that is a two-seat version specifically designed to also be able to do the air-to-ground mission in addition to the air-to-air mission. While both aircraft were built by, at that time, McDonnell Douglas, now Boeing, and look very similar from a commonality standpoint, about the first 6 feet of the airplane, the last 6 feet, and the outer 5 feet on the wingtips are about the only shared pieces. Everything else is really kind of new. The F-15E is a specifically different airplane, but very, very capable, and it can carry a lot of bombs.
You mentioned dogfighting and air superiority are the primary missions for the aircraft that you flew, and obviously, I guess that's code for shoot down the bad guys. But can you talk a little more to kind of, I guess, the tactics you would use to try to put yourself in the superior position where you can actually shoot someone down, and kind of just talk about maybe what an air-to-air engagement might look like in an aircraft of this era?
Sure. A fighter pilot's job is, once the decision is made to engage, fighter pilot's job is to get into a position of advantage. And that position of advantage is defined by getting into a position where you can employ weapons successfully against your adversary. A secondary goal is to try to get yourself into that position without putting yourself in the position where the adversary can employ weapons against you. And so that takes a lot of sensors in order to create that, because it's a big three-dimensional geometry problem. And this has been the case since we started, airplanes started doing air combat back effectively in World War I. It was always about one pilot seeing the other pilot early enough to be able to maneuver into a position of advantage. Early on, that was above and behind, because that's the hardest place for someone to see, your adversary to see above and behind. So it can maneuver in, and with guns that are fixed in an airplane, getting in close and in a stable platform when somebody doesn't see you makes it a lot easier to shoot them down. As weapons technology evolved and as airplane technology evolved over time, we added things like gun sights, radar gun sights, rockets, and eventually, of course, missiles, all of which either provided a new way of sensing the enemy and guiding weapons, or became different guiding weapons in themselves, such that today we've gotten to the point where, while fighters still have guns as a necessary last-ditch kind of weapon, principally, we look at missiles as being the primary weapon against any adversary aircraft, and of course, missiles need sensors to give them the data to cue them to where they need to go intercept the bad guy. So ultimately, now a fighter pilot's job is to integrate a whole bunch of sensors, from eyeballs to what you hear on the radio, so the ears, as well as all the technical systems on the aircraft, to be able to build a picture, a three-dimensional picture, calling situational awareness, what's going on around you, in order to be able to figure out what the proper actions are to take to get into that position of advantage.
So can you speak more specifically to how you use radar in these sorts of situations? I guess one instance is if you have a long-range radar and you can see your enemy to deploy missiles well before he can shoot them at you. But I believe before, when we've spoken, that you also talked about how it helps you to maneuver when you're closer in combat. Can you talk to both those points, please?
Sure, and I think it's worth noting at this point that the F-15C, the F-15A was designed around the radar. There were two principal design requirements for the aircraft. One of them was to be able to do a 4G turn at sustain a 4G turn at 30,000 feet, which is an aerodynamic problem, and so the wing is designed specifically to do that, as were the engines. But from a combat employment standpoint, for weapons, the APG-63 radar has got a 3-foot, 36-inch monopulse antenna, mechanically scanned in the front of the airplane. And it was that antenna and the whole back end of the radar that was one of the key design requirements or design drivers for the aircraft. The APG-63 is a radar marvel. It is the first look-down, shoot-down radar that was put into an aircraft. It's a monopulse antenna, and it really opened up the world of air combat. Obviously, pulse radars have a great deal of difficulty detecting targets looking down out of the clutter. And Doppler-only radars have their own limitations. The APG-63, which was originally designed and built by Hughes, brought these two things together and became really the major sensor that that the F-15 pilot had to learn how to master in executing the mission. Now, air-to-air radars do three principal things. Number one is they search. So look out there and you know, search for targets that are out in your area of concern. They track those targets when you decide that that's somebody that you want to pay attention to. So we go from a wide look to a much more narrow look. And then we use the radars to help identify the target out there. And we do that through the information that's passed from the radar to the pilot. Because once we go into track, you get important information like altitude, closure, geographic position, and things like that can give us some indication of the identity of this specific target that we're looking at that we fuse with other information that we get from other offboard sources to decide whether this is a bad guy or it's a good guy. And then once we determine whether it's a bad guy or a good guy, if they meet the requirements for us to be able to go ahead and shoot them. So that's whether they're hostile or not. And that's where we start to get into the rules of engagement, or ROE, that are a part of every military operation, where we can understand, we set out the rules of who's bad and when they're bad, when we can engage them. So a fighter pilot's job now, again, is really as a sensor manager and integrator that provides information that allows the pilot to decide where to maneuver the aircraft to get into that position of advantage that I mentioned earlier.
So you mentioned that the radar used in your plane was a mechanically scanned radar, and that has its certain limitations that you actually need to steer this thing, a presumably heavy antenna with motors. But along the way, there was a big upgrade in the technology. Can you talk about, even though you may not have flown with them, what in a scanned array is and how it is useful for a pilot?
Sure. And I actually did get the opportunity there. F-15s now do have electronically scanned antennas in them, and before I finished flying, I did get the opportunity to fly some of those aircraft. Yeah, a mechanically scanned antenna does have some limitations from an operations and maintenance standpoint. You know, the ABG-63 was hydraulically moved but electronically controlled, so it's high pressure hydraulic system that would move the aircraft the antenna through its area of operation to the gimbal limits. But the biggest limitation with a mechanically scanned array is that you really only have two modes that you can be in. One of them is search, and the other one is track. In search, you can see targets out there, but the update rate on that target is going to be limited by the scan volume that the antenna is going across. And all the scan volumes are defined. There are different ones that the pilot can select, but there's a balance between scanning, you know, covering a large area with the radar and having up-to-date information so that you don't have a great degree of latency in the search targets. When you go into track, obviously the degree of latency goes way down, but your awareness of what's going on in that search volume has now gone away. So you can only search, really, really focus on one target at a time. Now, there are different modes, track while scan and things like that, that allow you to keep track of multiple targets with an electronic or the mechanically scanned antenna, but they're not true track modes. And early on, track while scan modes did not support the launching of the primary air-to-air missile we had, which was the AIM-7. The AIM-7 is a semi-active radar missile, and it needed basically a high PRF signal in order to be able to track the target. We're not able to do track while scan with high PRF at a high enough data rate to be able to guide the AIM-7. Now, things changed with the AIM-120 or the AMRAAM. Track while scan modes do give sufficient data in most cases to guide a missile close enough to where it then takes over with its onboard radar. But mechanically scanned antennas really are limited in their ability to do those two things. You can either search or you can track, and there are trade-offs with both of them. the great thing with an electronically scanned antenna is that you can steer the beam to wherever you want and come up with schemes that allow you to focus in on specific volumes in a much more flexible way to be able to search that area. But also, their track while scan mode, we'll use it. It's really not that, but it's the best analog to a mechanically scanned antenna. Their track while scan modes do give a greater degree of fidelity of data on the target to be able to support weapons employment. Now, it has not changed in employing AIM-7s that you still need to go on into single target track to be able to track that target. However, we stopped carrying AIM-7s many, many years ago, and the AIM-120 now is our principal missile. The track modes within that are used by electronically scanned antennas are much better than in mechanically scanned antennas, and you can track multiple targets at high enough data rates at a great enough fidelity to be able to employ weapons. So the F-15 does have an electronically scanned antenna. The F-22 was fielded with it, as is the F-35. Electronically scanned antennas also have some real advantages when it comes to electronic countermeasures or electronic protection stuff, and some more flexibility from an electronic attack standpoint as well. So ECM and ECCM capabilities for those of us who are old enough to remember those terms.
You mentioned that the plane was designed around the antenna, and I'm sure that hasn't changed, or around the radar. I'm sure that hasn't changed. And also it sounds like with all this functionality, the search, the track, the identification, track while scan, all these different functions, that it probably requires a lot of interaction between the pilot and the actual radar system while they're flying the plane as well. Can you kind of talk to what the user interface is to control this radar system?
Sure. First, most people are very surprised when they see what the radar display actually looks like. It's a 4-inch by 4-inch monochrome green display that's in the upper left-hand corner of the cockpit dashboard. So it's really not that impressive. It's quite small when you look at it. Most people are really amazed when they see. We realize how much information and what you can do with such a limited display. But one of the other great leaps that the F-15 made when it was fielded was the way that the controls for the radar were integrated in for the pilot, and that there was a conscious effort that was made to design the aircraft in such a way that the pilot could operate the radar in a way, A, that would be safe, and B, be effective. Because in the past, when you look at the F-4 with which was our previous air superiority fighter, one of the previous air superiority fighters, the guy in the back seat, the weapons system officer, was responsible for running the radar. And generally he spent a lot of time heads down, looking at strobes, manually steering the antenna, and it was really quite intensive to be able to not only find targets, but then when they were found, to actually be able to track them. So the monopulse antenna gave us the ability to tell the radar, once it had seen a target, to go ahead and track that target in itself, and that process was automated. Once the pilot says, track that target, then the radar goes ahead and does so. The way that the pilot operates the radar is all done with left hand and right hand, and on the throttles are on the left side of the aircraft in the cockpit. There are several switches on the throttles that control different aspects of the radar. There's a wheel that we would rotate to control the azimuth scanning of the radar. There is a basically a cursor control that's on the throttle for the right engine that the pilot uses to move the cursors around the display to be able to draw out specific information, as well as to be able to see where the radar is looking. Because one of the most important things about it is to understand where the radar is looking in azimuth. And generally, you know, it's the F-15 has a plus or minus 60-degree scan, so 120 degrees total. But that scan volume, as I mentioned before, can be bumped down in azimuth, can be cut down to plus or minus 30, and there are times when that will be that would be appropriate. And actually, it could be cut down to plus or minus 15 as well, although that mode was used quite infrequently because it sacrifices one of the advantages of being able to scan larger volumes. But a lot of that is done with the left hand, so controlling the altitude coverage, controlling the azimuth coverage, and then controlling the range that's displayed on the radar display, which is the vertical situation display, or VSD. We would routinely either bump out or bump in the range that's displayed based on where we were in a fight. At a longer range, generally what you'd see is a pilot flying with an 80-mile scope, so 80 miles from the nose of the airplane out to the top of the scope is what we'd see. As we got in closer, though, we would bump down in so that, and this really just has to do with visual resolution on the VSD. Getting in closer, things that are close together will just seem like they're farther apart. So it's easier for the pilot to visually distinguish those on the radar scope. As far as track modes and things like that, once the pilot puts a target into track, which is done with the left hand, then the right hand comes into play, and that's where weapons are controlled. And also, another great thing about the ABG-63 was it had a series of automated modes that were oriented for visual maneuvering. That there's a volume scan called auto guns, in which when the pilot goes to that, the radar will lock onto the first thing that it sees within the defined volume, and it will do that automatically. So in a short-range fight, perhaps when there's a lot going on and pilot's looking outside, looking in one area, wants the radar to look in another, put it into auto guns, and the radar will lock onto the first thing that it finds. So that's one of the things that can be done. Then there are some other specific modes controlled by the right hand. There was a boresight mode. So if a pilot saw a target out there, instead of having to look inside to look at the radar scope to try and find that target and then put it into track, the pilot with his right hand could just basically point the antenna down the boresight of the aircraft, put the target that he sees in it, and the radar would go into track on that target. So there was another vertical scan mode, things that were very useful for dogfighting kind of stuff. But the whole system was designed around a concept called HOTAS, H-O-T-A-S, which stands for Hands on Throttle and Stick. And so it was made so that the pilot didn't have to look inside to operate the radar in the same way that two-seat aircraft did, with somebody specifically in the back, heads down. Over time, that system has evolved, and it's evolved very positively in that there are new things that can be done. And as radar capabilities improved and we put new modes in, we got to the point where we had to add more buttons onto the throttle and onto the stick in order to be able to for the pilot to be able to take advantage of those things. Early on, used to jokingly refer to flying or operating the radar is like playing the piccolo, in that all of the fingers, every single finger had something to do at some point in time. So it takes a while to learn how to do it, but like anything else, it really kind of becomes second nature, and it's really all part of air combat now.
So I'm hoping that somewhere out there in the audience listening to this show are the people who are going to be designing the next version of radar. So what is it that is the real pain point for pilots now? Do you think the next radar would be, throwing more transmit power at this thing so you can track further away, or you can scan more extreme off angle, like these things that engineers really seem to focus on? Or is it more of an upgrade of the user interface system so that it's easier to use for the pilots? Do you have a sense for what's kind of what are the sticking points for pilots flying today?
Yeah, you know, it's been a long time since the radar was the only sensor that fighters had on board. And so the big shift is that, and this happened, you know, quite a while ago, is that the radar is just one sensor. There are many, many sensors on the aircraft. And beginning with the F-22, to an extent beginning with the F-15, but really with the F-22 and now in the F-35, sensor fusion is the thing that makes aircraft capable at this point. So I think that going forward, what we're doing pretty well is understanding, you know, radars have strengths and they have limitations. You know, an electronically scanned antenna, one of the disadvantages of that is that it doesn't have one single beam size, right? Mechanically scanned antenna has a stable beam. But electronically scanned antennas, as you get off boresight, the beam gets, you know, smeared effectively, such that at 60 degrees, you know, you're at twice the beam width at that point. So twice the beam width, you have power out there, and you really can't get a very good track or detection once you get beyond 60 degrees. Now, if you want to put, you know, multifaceted antennas to give greater capability, sure. But the real challenge now is to use the radar for the things that it is best at, and then integrate in other sensors such that they can work with the radar to present the pilot as accurate a picture as possible so that the pilot can make the right decision at that time. So really what it is, it's all about this fused picture now and how to present the pilot all of this information that's coming in from all of these sensors in a way that is not overwhelming for the pilot. And there's been a lot of very good work that's been done to make this happen. When you look at the evolution from the F-15 to the F-22 and now to the F-35, the display that comes up to the pilot is really quite intuitive, and it's very useful. And, you know, the situation display that the pilot gets right now is really very helpful for it. So, you know, as I don't think that radars are ever going to go away from fighters because they have got so many strengths as a sensor. You know, the challenge now is just maintaining that strength and taking advantage of it, and you know, really kind of countering the things that the bad guys do to take advantage of the weaknesses in the radar. You know, electronic countermeasures and things like that try to either decrease detection range or decrease the ability to track and provide weapons guidance or anything like that.
So, what do you think is the future of air-to-air combat? Do you think humans have a part in that, or do you think we're going to shift more and more towards a fully sensor-only system on an airframe?
One thing that's really not, I think, well understood broadly is that we have been adopting automation in aircraft from the very beginning of when we started flying. Through autopilots, everything else I already talked about, you know, how much automation there was in the APG-63. And that, you know, the F-15 flew operationally in the U.S. Air Force in 1976 for the first time. And there were many automatic modes in the radar. So we, over time, have been adopting more and more automation. As systems have gotten better, they've gotten more complex, we have been designing them so that the pilot can take advantage of those systems. And the systems, you know, let machines do what machines do well, let humans do what humans do well. Do I think that at some point we will have the technical capability to, you know, remove the human from the cockpit and perform the air-to-air mission? Sure. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. How close that is quite up for discussion, though. I think we're a very long way away from it because air-to-air combat, air-to-ground combat, anything else, is incredibly complex, and it's never the same. It's a very dynamic environment. And if you look at the challenges we're facing right now just with autonomous cars and the dynamic environment that they're in and having to process and handle all those types of things, you've got all of that plus a third dimension and a potentially bad guy who's out there shooting back at you to complicate the situation. And it's not just a bad guy that's out there trying to shoot you down. It's a bad guy that responds to everything that you do and is going to do things to try to get you confused. So there's an active participant on the other end that's trying to make things harder for you. And what we like to say is the enemy gets a vote. It's not just the good guy that gets to say what's going to happen. The enemy gets a vote in what the final result is. So I think that we've got a long way to go before we get to a point where we can deal with that complexity. That completely puts aside the policy question of allowing machines to make decisions to employ deadly force in a combat situation, and that's a conversation that is ongoing. So I think that what's important to keep in mind with these in this discussion is that even if the human is not in the aircraft, there's still a human in that loop somewhere, and I see that there's going to be a human participating in that loop for certainly for the foreseeable future, and probably well beyond that, in that there are no truly, autonomous on their own systems. And I don't think that this is an area where they'll be created. There will be a human participating in the loop at some point. Now, the farther the human gets away from the pointy end of the system, the more important data link and data latency and all that kind of stuff comes in. And in a highly dynamic, very fast-moving environment, you need right up-to-date data to make the best decisions for what's going on. So technologically, we're going to get there. From a policy standpoint, I don't know how that's going to play out, but I also think that there will be a human in the loop somewhere, and I think it's less and less important where that human is to the discussion, whether fighters have people in them, whether they don't. That's a restricted way of thinking of the fighter itself as a system. Fighters actually plug into a much greater air combat system that's been designed for effective command and control, effective targeting. And so it's really, the fighter itself is really just one piece of a much greater system that has got all kinds of inputs coming into it. So there's always going to be a human who's involved in this thing. And again, I'll go back to, as this system evolves and as technology evolves, what we're doing is trying to get machines to do what machines do well and allow humans to do what humans do well.
That's a very fascinating take on the matter. I've learned some things that I'd never even really considered there. So are there any final thoughts you want to share with the audience? It can be about yourself. It can be a message to the warfighters, a message to the engineers. Really feel free to say whatever you want here.
I think the biggest thing I learned over my time as a fighter pilot was that it's great to walk out to the airplane and strap in and be the only person in the aircraft and take off and realize that there are several tens of thousands of pounds of thrust at literally at your fingertips, wonderful radar, all kinds of stuff going on, but really being a fighter pilot is far more about being an effective team member. We never went out and employed on our own. Our basic fighting unit was a four-ship of airplanes. So there were four of us out there. So we worked as a team of four. And that team of four sometimes worked with three other teams of four, and we had 12 airplanes out there. Those 12 airplanes are a team. That team fits into a bigger team overall because, in general, we were out there to help protect other people who are dropping bombs or doing surveillance or something like that. So there's a a bigger and bigger and bigger team that you can understand that you start to fit into, even though you can see the lone, it's nice to think of the lone knight of the sky. The other thing is to think about the fighter pilot as a member of a human machine team. And the human machine team is defined by the pilot sitting in the aircraft. And the first the first element of that team is right there, defined by the, you know, the outer mold line of that aircraft that's got the radar in it, all the other sensors, and that pilot there. But this human machine team also extends out in the same way that I talked about the other pieces, in that we are, you know, it's humans and machines working together to achieve a specific objective. And I think that's the most important thing for people to keep in mind going forward, is that, you know, human-machine teaming is not a question of making humans and machines and kind of mashing them together. If you look at the evolution of aircraft design, as we've talked about with the F-15, specific decisions were made to make it easier for the human to work with the machines in an effective way to achieve a single objective. So keeping that in mind, that it is this human-machine team that we're building. We're not just building a radar or some other sensor to be slapped on an airplane. We're building a piece that's got to plug into this bigger picture that extends well beyond the outer mold line of the airplane to this grander system.
All right, Ray. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure everyone is really going to enjoy listening to this episode.